There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
It's probably time for me to once again explain that the ending of that little song, The Way is the Adam's Way, is I'm not trying to tell people to take it Adam's way, my way, or the highway. I like to play with the fact that my last name, surprisingly enough, similar sounds to the word atoms, and atomic energy is what we're all about here. I also want to take this opportunity to let you all know that the Atomic Show and Atomic Insights are independent publications designed to share information as widely as possible. There are costs associated with producing and distributing this information. I gladly bear most of those, but whenever people decide it's time for them to step up and support the show or the blog, it's always welcome. There is a donate button on the front page of the Atomic Insights blog, and if you care to decide you're going to throw some money in the kitty, I'll say thank you very much. And if you want, I'll even say thank you very much in public for those people who'd like a little recognition. So the Atomic Show's going to be here for a long time, but the more resources we have, the better we can make it, the more conferences we can cover, and the more traveling we can have to go to other places that need to hear the word that atomic energy is important, valuable, and exciting. Thank you. This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. And I'm going to bring you something that you all haven't heard in a while. I have with me a distinguished panel of guests. Dan Yerman, who blogs at Neutron Bites. Meredith Angwin, who blogs at Yes Vermont Yankee and Northwest Energy. Northwest Clean Energy. That's a Northwest Clean Energy. Steve Applin, who blogs at Canadian Energy Issues. And Les Kourish, who is the intrepid blogger at Hiroshima Syndrome, who continues to follow whatever is happening in Japan associated with Fukushima, even though it's now been, four and a half years. Welcome to you all.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
Nice to be here.
All right.
Nice to be here.
Okay, Dan, let's start with you. Introduce yourself real briefly, and then we'll go to Meredith, then Steve, and then Les.
This is Dan Yerman, and welcome the listening audience. I'm based in Cleveland, Ohio, and I blog at Neutron Bites.
Meredith?
This is Meredith Angwin. I'm based in Wilder, Vermont, a place nobody's heard of. And I blog at Yes Vermont Yankee and also at Northwest Clean Energy.
Steve?
Hi, I'm Steve Applin. I'm from Ottawa, Canada, one of many Ottawas in North America, but the only one in Canada, and I blog at Canadian Energy Issues. Nice to hear somebody else's voice. Dan, it's been a while.
Hey, I'm Les Carice, and I'm also from Cleveland. Dan and I get together for lunch once in a while. And I blog at Fukushima Accident Updates and Fukushima Commentary on my Hiroshima Syndrome site.
All right. Welcome to you all, and I'm glad to hear all the voices. Steve, you wanted to say hello to Dan?
Yeah. Dan, it's been a while.
Yeah, nice to hear your voice, Steve.
Yeah. And Meredith, nice to hear you. And Les, I think we spoke once before. And Rod, it's always nice.
Thanks, Steve. And it's always nice to speak to all of you. Since we've last spoken, there have been a lot of things going on, but I want to focus on some of the meetings that have happened in the last several weeks, including a ongoing meeting with the South Australia Royal Commission, which is doing an evaluation on nuclear energy and whether or not they should seize the international economic opportunities offered by hosting used nuclear fuel storage temporarily while they set up an industry to recycle that used fuel into valuable fuel materials. Have any of you been tracking what's been going on in the testimony in the last week or so?
I've been following it a little bit. It's Les Carice here. And at this point, I believe they're canvassing public comments more than anything else. I don't know if they're in the testimony phase yet. At least I haven't read that. I don't. Do you know any better about that, Rod?
There have been some testimonies offered within the last week or so. I've gotten a few press releases. I know that Senator Sean Edwards provided some written testimony, and there's been some testimony offered by Ben Hurd, who was supposed to be on this call, but apparently had something come up last minute, and he wasn't able to be here. So we may not be able to do too much on this, but let's see who else has seen what's been going on in South Australia.
I wanted to mention that I did stick my nose into their website a few times over the last couple of weeks, and it seems that the South Australia Royal Commission is trying to do this correctly. If you call bringing everybody and their brother into the mix, there's been some really outrageous written objections, shall we say, to what they're doing. I think they're trying to do the job right.
Well, there's also been some really well reasoned, supportive comments from people who recognize that the materials in question are not hazardous to store and have a real potential economic payback if South Australia develops the industry necessary to turn them back into useful materials. And these days, I don't know if you all have been following the general trend of Australia's economy, but being a natural resources-based economy, they had a real nice run for the last 15 or so years as China was, you know, building new cities few miles apart from each other, and they were consuming an awful lot of steel and concrete and coal and buying everything they could from the international market, and other people were experiencing some growth. So natural resources are a great place to be up until about a year or so ago, and now Australia's economy is slowing rather dramatically. And so there may be some renewed interest in finding new ways to use some of the human resources that they have and also some of their rather large quantities of open space.
A lot of those large quantities are pretty hot and dry. South Australia, though, does have a uranium mine, if I remember correctly. So it's not like they're just throwing their hat into the ring without some reason for it.
This is Dan.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Australia's main customer for its iron ore and for its coal and some of its other basic commodities is China. And as you know, China's economy, as best Western sources can determine, is slowing down. And this has affected Australia's exports to China for that purpose. And so some of the mines have been consolidating, some have been cutting back on what they're doing. So there is an international aspect to this.
Yeah, Australia has also been has been developing a pretty strong liquefied natural gas export capability. There's been some major investments in that industry. Somebody just went off mute. But the prices of natural... I'm hearing myself again. Okay, the prices of liquefied natural gas have dropped rather dramatically in the past year, partially because of the drop in oil prices, but also because Japan is starting to dial back on its demand, as well as South Korea has dialed back on its demand, both of which have started up at least a few nuclear plants that have reduced their need to buy LNG to produce electricity. So there's motivation for why Australia has a need to take a look at a new industry, and also some real solid technical reasoning for people to say this industry is clean, it's safe, it's an area that niche that people really seem to want to have filled, and we have the knowledge and assets ready to fill it. One of the nice things about Australia is I don't think there would be very many people who worry about Australia as a place to put used nuclear fuel with regard to them possibly using the material for nefarious purposes.
This is Dan Uhrman again. While Australia is considering that, there's also work going on in the U.S. in two places. Interestingly enough, about 50 miles apart, in West Texas, in Andrews, Texas, a waste control specialists has partnered with Areva to develop an interim storage spent fuel facility. And in Hobbs, New Mexico, Holtec, which makes dry cask containers, has formed a consortium with local economic development groups to create a similarly interim storage facility. These will be surface facilities. They won't be underground. The facilities could be in business for 50 to 100 years, depending on how long the stuff is stored there. And both are very serious about going for licenses from the NRC in 2016. Now, it's important to note that the NRC doesn't choose one or the other. It's entirely possible that both projects could get licenses from the NRC. I think the limiting factor will be whether investors can be convinced to show up. The lure of this, of course, is the fees associated with storing spent nuclear fuel, which requires almost no maintenance and no operation. So it's a relatively low, uncomplicated, low overhead activity. The revenue is very clear. The question is, of course, DOE has title to the fuel, and whether or not it would allow these commercial facilities to arrange for transportation by rail to either site probably is a policy issue that future administration is going to have to decide.
I'm glad you bring that up. That area of Texas and New Mexico has recognized in a similar fashion as South Australia that taking care of what other people don't want to do in the nuclear fuel cycle seems to be a pretty good niche to be in, particularly if you're in an area that doesn't have a tremendous amount of alternatives for people to think about. I believe that area is very close to where the waste isolation pilot plant is, and it's also close to where Urenco operates an enrichment facility. Correct me if
I'm
wrong, Dan.
That's correct. The WIP site is in that corner of New Mexico, and the Urenco site, which is now a 4.5 million SWU per year facility, is in Eunice, New Mexico. So if you'll pardon the pun, it is a hotbed of nuclear activity. Even now, I might add that one other issue has also come up, and that is that there are ongoing debates within and without the Department of Energy over the future of the MOX fuel plant now under construction in South Carolina. And economic development groups in New Mexico have told DOE, look, if you're not going to finish the MOX plant, send the plutonium here. We'll stick it in WIP. The problem with that is twofold. The first is that the WIP site is currently closed due to a fire in February 2014. The reopening date is still to be determined. DOE is going to spend $500 million on improvements, and then the safety reviews have to follow that. The second issue is before the plutonium could be stored at WIP, it would have to be repackaged at a facility in Los Alamos, which still would require major upgrades and could take as long as 18 months to 3 years to get ready. So these kinds of political battles sometimes take place in the absence of technical reality or an appreciation of technical reality. I know that's a cue for Steve to jump in because he's a good observer of these kinds of things. So take it away, Steve.
Yeah, I just this is Steve Applin. Thanks, Dan. And I just want to place a bet. My bet is on the MOX plant in South Carolina going ahead. That's what's going to happen to that plutonium. Anybody want to take me up? I'll bet 25 Canadian cents.
Wow.
I only bet big time. I'm a high roller.
Is that American cents, 30?
Yeah, it's 30 American cents, so, you know. Andy up.
No, actually, I think these days it's only 20 American cents. The American dollar is superior in value to the Canadian dollar. Again, partly because Canada is a natural resources economy that does very well when the rest of us aren't doing so well, and not so well when others of us start to enjoy low fuel prices. So,
we do very well when the fuel prices, the world price of petroleum is high.
Yes.
We don't do well when the world price is what it is now.
Yep. So I'm not certain who's going to win the political battle. I know that South Carolina is still very interested in continuing the MOX project and finishing that. There are still a lot of people who would prefer to continue down the road that we've already gone rather than to start down a path whose costs are, as Dan pointed out, uncertain and with a very uncertain schedule. Because although the WIPS facility operated very well for 15 years, it also has demonstrated the vulnerability of one facility. They had a problem that wasn't just that they had the fire and then a very small burp from a improperly packaged waste canister. And that little burp, which was caused by a simple misreading of procedure or misapplication of procedure and no review that caught it, resulted in the complete closure of the facility. Now, it's been over 2 years, and as Dan mentioned, the recovery from that one mistake may require the expenditure of somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion, because anytime the DOE says it's an estimated $500 million, I double it before the project is complete. So that's a real vulnerability if you have something that's that fragile where a single mistake can result in closure for that length of time. I've always been a fan of surface storage. I think it's very safe. It's keeps the waste where it should be in the view of people who have entrepreneurial thoughts and say, look at all that material that's piling up there. I wonder if there's something we can do with it. This is the thing that led to the invention of such delicacies as sausage. When somebody has a waste, other people look at that and say, there's got to be some way to put that material to use, to make it valuable. And I personally don't mind having it sit exactly where it is, but perhaps it's too hidden from view and too dispersed for people to say, we really have enough inventory here to start building a plant that can make use of this material. So it is interesting, Dan, that you brought up the potential competitors to South Africa, because I hope that they don't expect that the world market is going to let them have free rein if they volunteer to accept use nuclear fuel. They won't get everybody's.
Well, I don't know that you're going to see U.S. spent fuel going to Australia. I don't think we have any worries there. But the Australia site could certainly be home for spent fuel from both South Korea and Japan, neither of which have a high-level waste repository, and both of which are going to have great difficulty citing one because they do have so many other claims for land uses. So I think those are the two primary customers for Australia. India might be convinced to play, but for national security reasons, they probably won't. But that said, South Korea and Japan could provide a fair amount of revenue for South Australian spent fuel surface interim storage facility for a very long time.
I'd add Taiwan to that list as well, because Taiwan's got a particularly challenging siting issue. They're a very small landmass with a lot of people, and they do have four nuclear plants that have been operating for several decades now, so they would be a customer as well, I would think.
This was Carice again. I was going to add Taiwan, but I would also like to say that Japan's very interested in doing everything themselves, and they do have a program right now that's directed towards a high-level waste repository, but they're having so much trouble doing siting work, basic geological testing, if you will, for low-level wastes, that I think the possibility of Japan becoming a customer for Australia is not out of the question at some point in the future. There's an awful lot of not in my backyard going on in Japan right now.
Everywhere. There's an international dispute between my country and your country over Lake Huron. We're supposed to be putting, this is not spent fuel, a low and intermediate level waste repository on the Bruce Peninsula near the Bruce plant. Right. And the Michigan State government, boy, they're all up in arms, and it's going international.
You're right.
Well, we all of us, I believe, think that we have a role to play in trying to improve people's perception that having nuclear facilities in their backyard is actually a good thing. They're actually pretty good neighbors, and they don't make a mess. They provide good jobs, and the areas that would normally consider hosting a federal prison, for example, would probably find used nuclear fuel to be a much better guest, far better behaved in the local community, and probably wouldn't result in some sort of international manhunt for several months just because one of the spent fuel assemblies got a wild desire to break out and find its way into the general public.
This is Dan. I want to come back to Japan as a potential customer for South Australia. The Japanese will close five smaller reactors that are over 40 years. Les is probably much more attuned to this than I am, but so I'll ask him to jump in, and I'll be brief. That all the spent fuel associated with them is going to need a home. The other thing is Japan continues to have aspirations for reprocessing to make MOX. If they stored their spent fuel in Australia, it'd be easy enough for them to get it back when they were ready to reprocess it. So the issue of getting the spent fuel out from the closed reactors and from at reactor storage has a certain benefit in terms of optics for the Japanese public, then getting it back when you're ready to reprocess, you're bringing it back as you need it, and the Australians hold the bulk of it until you call for it. Seems to be a possibly attractive scenario, though there are a lot of imponderables associated with how the Japanese might think about it. But as an American, looking at it from an entrepreneurial point of view, seems to make sense to me.
I'll go along with you as a possibility. Trying to look ahead and see what's going to happen in Japan in the future with spent fuel there's a lot of wishful thinking, I think. They do have a reprocessing facility that's been in the testing phase. It's been constructed. I can't remember the name of it. It starts with an R.
Rokasho Mira.
That's it. That's been running into a number of technical issues for over a decade. If they could ever get that working and then actually begin producing mocks themselves, I think that would lower the possibility of sending it to Australia. But until the reprocessing facility gets through all their technical issues, I think you got to hold the door open for Australia getting involved.
Well, even if they do get Rokasho Mira started up, they'll be that facility is very similar to the one that Steve and I visited in La Hague in France. So they still have residue from that system that would need to be disposed of somewhere or stored somewhere for a considerable period of time. So they still could be looking for a host like South Australia for some of that material. Even though that process takes some of the valuable material and recycles it, some of the potentially valuable isotopes remain, and South Australia may accept those as well or get into that business. All right, so Meredith, you've been very quiet. Apparently this is not your area of expertise.
It's far from my area of expertise. The only thing I was thinking about is that Australia has, I think, a federal law that it's non-nuclear Australia, and they have put limits on even how much uranium they can mine. I mean, there's some kind of legal limit on that, too, I believe. So the idea that they will accept useful just a little, I don't know, it just seemed a little...
Dan, did you go off mute again?
Anyway, I was just surprised.
Les, turn off mute. There you go.
I'm here.
Okay, Meredith, go ahead. Somebody was typing and letting us listen to the typing, so you go ahead.
Not me.
I'm a touch typist. That wasn't me either.
That was me. I give up.
Well, I was just saying that, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert on it at all, Australia has a law against having nuclear reactors in Australia, and it also has some limitation on how much uranium it will mine, even for export, again, because of nuclear phobia. And so when we begin talking about, and Australia will store used fuel, I'm like, well, I don't know. It seems to me that even though Australia definitely has large areas where economic activity is difficult and it's a resource kind of thing, you know, they export raw materials instead of finished goods. I just don't see a country that has those laws against mining and using uranium eager to accept spent fuel. So, but the thing is, I don't follow it as close as you guys do. So, I end up saying these things, and they're more of a feeling than a well, I was watching what their commission is saying or what their parliament, etc.
Well, Meredith, it's an important observation, and you are correct that Australia has a law that was passed by a former government that does restrict their nuclear activities. However, I always like to remind people that any law passed by humans can be changed by humans. And I know that people look at me and say, well, you can't tell me if politics can actually do something. But the reality is that as long as the law is not given to us by God or nature, whichever you prefer to look at, the laws can be changed. So recognition that some people have, and some of the people involved in that South Australia activity are politicians. They understand what the rules are today, and what their goal is to try to show their public through a very open and above board process that invites commentary from everyone, including very knowledgeable scientists and engineers, shows them that there is a reason to go back and reevaluate the actions of a past government. And I think that that's an admirable capability, similar to what happened in Great Britain when a government that was pretty anti-nuclear and a population that was pretty anti-nuclear had the facts about their North Sea gas deposits explained to them in a very careful fashion, and eventually the whole population got behind the idea that the UK needs to allow people to do nuclear energy, otherwise they're going to be dependent on imported natural gas, probably sourced from such friends as Russia and Iran.
I'd like to throw something in here. This is why I was typing. I wanted to look into Australian law, and they do have prohibitions against certain nuclear actions unless federal approval is obtained. And it turns out that they're not called states. What are they called? They're territories. Wants to get indulged in something that has to do with like nuclear fuel fabrication, nuclear power plant, enrichment, reprocessing facility, waste facility. I'm just going down the list here. They would have to get first territory-wide approval from the different governments, and local and the such, and then they would have to send it to the federal government, whether or not they're going to approve it. So, yeah, there's a law there, but it's got a lot of back doors. It turns out that the two territory legislations that seem to be the most prohibitive are South Australia and Victoria. And I think if the South Australia government's willing to look into something here for a variety of different functions with nuclear, it's not just waste disposal, then there must be a way of doing it.
Well, I agree with you, and laws can be changed, and it looks to me like what you're saying is that it's not actually that hard to get
less.
Yeah?
Meredith is echoing again.
Oh.
No, it's not Meredith. It's not you. Keep speaking, Meredith.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say that I'm happy for that information, because it sounds like even though the laws are there, there's almost an administrative remedy in the sense that if you can get this or that permission, it's already built into the law that you can do it if you can get this or that permission, either from the federal government or from the territory government. I didn't quite follow which was going on. And I think that is really important to know. Because actually writing a new law and getting it passed is much harder, in my opinion, than getting a permission or a taking an action which is already written into an existing law. You know, it's already there. We just do it this time. Okay, fine. But my concern was more, as I say, more about... I guess what I'm thinking about is if you're up in the Northeast, we've got a lot of granite, but if people in the Northeast in the United States aren't accepting working power plants that get them off of natural gas and fossil fuels, and aren't eager to keep these power plants, and you know, Vermont absolutely harassed Vermont Yankee, and Massachusetts, offices of the governors of Massachusetts have not exactly been warm and cuddly toward their power plants. And anyway, what I'm trying to say is nobody in their right mind would think, oh, well, you know, the Northeast has a lot of granite. We'll do storage there. If they won't accept a power plant which has all the advantages of making power, not using fossil fuels, providing lots of jobs, how are they going to accept spent fuel? I mean, that's what I'm thinking. It's sort of like that's higher on the oh please don't bring it near me list than a power plant, in my opinion.
I wonder, Rod, you were mentioning above ground storage. That sort of dovetails into something that I was thinking of and relates to what Meredith's talking about. I think that all storage should be above ground, you know, until they find a deep geological repository that everybody accepts. I'm speaking in the case of Canada. We're decades away from finding a community that that accepts this, you know, in spite of all the benefits. But above ground storage, I toured the Darlington dry cask facility last year. I think that everybody should do this. The utility should strenuously promote these tours. The organization that's looking for the deep geological repository here in Canada has been promoting this kind of stuff, but their budget is not big enough. But the more people see this stuff, everybody has the same look on their face when you tell them, yeah, the bundle goes into the reactor, comes out the reactor, pretty much looking exactly the same as it was when it went in. People think that this blows up in the reactor, that explodes and it's got this, you know, green sludge coming out the other side. When they look at it and they're standing feet away from a dry cask that contains hundreds of years of power for people's homes, their attitude changes. I think that you know, we could stand with more public education around this and these above ground facilities. The more of them there are, the better, especially if there are tourists in them.
Agreed. And one of the things I spend too many hours doing is staring out my back windows and looking at the vista between me and the mountains, that I can see a lot of places where you could hide a considerable amount of our used fuel inventory, and I wouldn't even be able to see it. Yet it would be sitting right in my backyard, and it'd be perfectly content to just sit there in its concrete container for as long as necessary. And if for some reason in 60 or 80 or 200 years the container begins to experience some degradation, why, all you need to do is go and move the fuel into a new container. I'm not sure I understand why the industry hasn't told people how simple it is. Now, it's not inexpensive. Those containers are about $1 million a piece. But the thing that people need to recognize, at least from the U.S. perspective, is that about three of them can contain all of the waste that is generated during an 18-month power run, during which period the facility will have generated, about 10 billion kilowatt hours of electricity, actually a little bit more than that, during that 18-month run. So that's a pretty low-cost storage facility for the waste from that much power generation.
Well, I say that to people a lot because I try to make it very kind of personal in the sense that I say, look, you know, I have visited both the Merrimack Coal Station, which was a very well-run coal station over in New Hampshire, and Vermont Yankee. And Vermont Yankee was 600 megawatts, and Merrimack's about 480 or something like this. I said, Merrimack uses 40 coal cars a day. Vermont Yankee uses 3 semis every 18 months. I mean, so basically the amount of waste that's being made at Vermont Yankee is 3 semis every 18 months. And over at Merrimack, it's whatever ash and so forth they're making from 40, 100-ton coal cars per day. And, I mean, that brings it better than saying, because when you say, oh, it's a million times more, it's a billion, we've got all these, you know, deficits and government actions. So pretty soon that all those big numbers begin to run together for us. But actually, you know, 3 semis versus 18 months versus 40 coal cars a day, that you can visualize.
Thoroughly agree. All right, so we're going to skip off the South Australian Royal Commission's deliberations. I did visit their website just to let people know what the phase they're in now is. They're in the regional and remote engagement series number 3, where they're visiting a number of areas and local communities, town halls, and having barbecues and listening to people give their responses, either positive or negative, as they're gathering more information. So keep appraised of that. This Royal Commission is one of those very well-defined processes where a democratic society can help make a good decision by listening to people who really understand what they're talking about, as well as listening to those who have a lot of feelings about something. And feelings are important. It is important to address how people respond and what they think is happening. And perhaps most of them, once they can visit and see and listen to people who really spend their time doing this, they will accept that in this case, the experts really know what they're talking about, and the activity that they're suggesting is one that would be valuable and safe, acceptably safe as any of the other activities they accept on a routine basis. The World Nuclear Association also had a meeting over the last couple of days, where they had some interesting presentations. One of the ones that I wanted to mention was that they had a discussion on small modular reactors and gave an update as to which nations are moving forward. Talked about the fact that Russia, Argentina, and China all have small reactors that are under construction today, and discussed how Saudi Arabia and I'm losing track of the other one. There's two nations that said, we're very interested in this technology and we'd like to become investors and take a look at what's really appropriate for our nations. And I'll look and find the other country while I'll let other people talk here.
The Argentinian thing is really interesting. Their CARAM reactor, which as you said, is under construction. That's interesting country, but the politics, they just happen to have a president that's very supportive of it right now, and as you know, those things, presidents get voted out, they get deposed, and those sorts of things come to an end, but they're you know, you make hay when the sun is shining, and good luck to them.
The Argentines ability to pay for that reactor is going to be kind of an issue. Okay, the three reactors are in order that Ron mentioned them. The KLT-40S, 150 megawatt reactor thermal. It's PWR type. It's based on their icebreaker reactor, but they've added safety reliability features, passive features, and it uses low enriched uranium for fuel. China's HTRPM is a HTGR. Being built in Shandong, which is basically one of China's nuclear cities. This is going to be a 600 megawatt reactor. There's some speculation that Bill Gates' TerraPower may be involved with this development, but that's not been confirmed. And then finally, the CARAM 25 is a 25 megawatt PWR with natural coolant circulation, and it's next to the Atucha, if I pronounce that correctly, nuclear power station in Lima, which is about 100 kilometers northwest of Buenos Aires. Go ahead, Steve.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, Saudi Arabia jumped in. They are, of course, have a deal with South Korea, which they just signed recently. And they Koreans have what's called the smart SMR design that they are hoping to sell there. And this is a first mover deal for South Korea based on the confidence that they've built up in the region with their success in moving ahead with the four reactors being built, they're building for the UAE. And so the Saudis have turned to them. The Saudis at one time had a plan for 16 1,000 plus megawatt reactors. They have now shelved that. Official word is they've pushed it back by 8 years. But the fact is the Saudis recognized that they simply couldn't manage a build of that size. They didn't have the regulatory structure, the engineering talent, the supply chain. They also now don't have the revenue because the price of oil has just cratered. So I think they're coming back to look at SMRs as a much more feasible way to get their feet in the water with nuclear without having to bust the bank, as it were. So they're very interested in what the South Koreans have to offer, and South Koreans have high confidence in the Middle East because of what they're doing in the UAE. So we're going to see, watch that very, very closely and see how that goes. I think it's going to be interesting.
And I'm believing that it's good for people to recognize where they are and what their limitations are, and especially in terms of the things that you mentioned, Dan, with regulatory and project management responsibilities. Starting off big is not easy. The agreement that the UAE made with South Korea was a rather unique situation where they did allow a lot of work to begin with to set up their regulatory structure, and they focused it in a way that allowed another supplier to come in and provide almost everything without doing a lot of localization, and a supplier that had a good solid experience level for the reactors they were building. They didn't bring in reactors that they'd never built before to another country.
Well, the Saudis have been following that model. They've brought in nuclear regulators from Finland, which has four nuclear power plants, is building a fifth, and have had quite a bit of assistance from them in terms of trying to figure that out. Their regulatory infrastructure still isn't fully in place. What the UAE did is they followed the American model, and they actually brought in some people, some retired people from the USNRC, and also Dale Klein, the former chairman of the NRC, was a consultant to them. So they went out and got the gold standard on nuclear regulatory advice in setting up their own infrastructure.
All right. I was going to also, when I sent out the invitations, ask Ben for a review of his talk where he talked about he has – and his PhD research has been doing some reviews of such interesting plans as the 100% renewables plan offered by Mark Jacobson at Stanford University. He gave a presentation at the World Nuclear Association about that, his review, and showed how many holes there are in that plan, many hand-waving assumptions that say, well, yes, it could be done as long as you're willing to do X, X, and X, where there's no indication that any government is willing to do all those things. It's not a matter of will, as some people might say. It's a matter of infrastructure and investment that would be required to provide a system that is not as reliable as one we have today. So, but Ben is not able to come, so I'm going to skip over that part, and we'll move on to talking a little bit more about the DOE NRC workshop that was held September 1st and 2nd on licensing and developing advanced non-light water reactors in the United States. I was able to attend that, so I've got some thoughts I'd like to share with people. But before that, I'd like to ask my guests if they paid much attention to this meeting and have any questions.
This is Dan. I did pay attention to it. I've been covering advanced nuclear reactors for a while on my blog. I did an interview with Sam Britton when he had completed his report on the potential for development of commercial development of advanced reactors in the U.S., and published his report at the Third Way And then I published on my blog, this is shameful promotion on my part, a directory of the advanced nuclear reactors that were in Sam's report. And I published that the day before the conference got going, but I don't think anybody there read it, but that's how that goes. And so I've been very interested. The other thing I'll mention before Rod jumps into his on the from the street level there report is that the NRC also published a web page with all of the presentations on their website. I think that was a very good move on their part to make that stuff available. The key issue that I come away from with all the ferment that you have with entrepreneurial activity going on with advanced reactors and so forth is I don't see much prospect for any of them achieving commercial success in the U.S. because the NRC is not presenting any initiatives to Congress to provide an additional line of funding that would get them smart on how to license advanced reactors. Their attitude is if someone comes in with a license request, we'll get smart at their expense. And I don't think that's the right approach.
Well, I agree with you. That's not the right approach, and that's not the message that I heard between the words that the people of the NRC who were at the meeting were saying. And having been a bureaucrat and a resources-focused bureaucrat, I was at Navy headquarters for 9 years as a what we call a requirements officer, which is one who analyzes programs, determines how much money is needed, and then helps build the budgets to make sure that programs have the resources they need to succeed. What I heard the NRC people saying was, vendors, interested folks, potential customers need to understand something about our economic picture. We are, by law, an independent agency that has a certain set task, and we have a certain means of funding that task that is written down in the Atomic Energy Act and as modified by several amendments that have been given to that act over the years. Without a change in law, audience, we can't do anything to begin making preparations without charging our existing customers a fee for that activity. And those existing customers are those who operate existing plants and have no real vested interest in encouraging the development of advanced reactors. So they're not terribly interested in paying those fees. So if you, audience, are interested in advanced reactors and giving us the capability and the responsibility for developing the ability to review and license advanced reactors, we need you to go to your congressmen and representatives and tell them what we should be doing and to give us the resources necessary. I heard that loud and clear. The NRC is not the promotional arm. It is not the agency that should go out and survey what the technology is available and try to make preparations to be ready for that. However, if they are directed to be ready to review advanced technology, if they're directed to have the right people on staff who are fully versed in the ins and outs of the new inventions or the old inventions made new again that are being developed, then they will certainly do that. That's their job. So it's up to us, people, and I mean those of you who are listening to this podcast and are interested in advanced reactors, to figure out a way to tell our legislators that they need to enable the NRC to be ready to enable the development of advanced reactors here in the United States. I know that there are people listening outside the United States, and forgive my rather nationalistic views here, but we have a lot of talent that we need to be sharing with the world, and it's a lot easier for us to share that talent if we do our homework here and build what we can build here and prove that it works before we try to sell it to somebody else. So we really need this capability. We need to have the NRC not limited to having to collect fees from the operating utilities, who have many other priorities from the NRC. They really want the NRC to be efficient and to do its rulemakings on all the things that they say they've got in progress. They don't want them to delay those decisions too long. They want them to have a, they have a whole list of things that are their priorities. If we want the NRC to have some new priorities, we have to use our ability as tax-paying citizens of the United States of America to push our representatives to enable the NRC to do its job.
This is Dan Rod. I really appreciate your taking us through that. I do have an idea that is based on current practice that DOE and NRC might pursue. The DOE is already has a cost-sharing agreement with NuScale for development of a light water reactor type, an SMR. And what they're doing is providing funding on a cost-sharing basis with the vendor so that their investors don't go broke while the NRC charges them a fee to review the safety and then to review the license application. Now, the DOE could extend that model to advanced reactors by looking at the development of what I would call reference designs. For the sixth, and just for the sake of discussion, I'll take the types that are in the Gen 4 series. And suppose you were to, as DOE, have an appropriation from an R&D perspective that created a reference design that the NRC could get smart on. You would put funding in the appropriations of both agencies, and so that they would have a framework of understanding not only what the ins and outs of a commercial reactor might look like, but also what the safety issues would be for these different technology types, which would then get some of the heavy lifting out of the way. And then the DOE could turn around in a second stage and do the same thing for an advanced reactor vendor that they're doing for NuScale, which is provide a cost-sharing agreement for design and for licensing approval. This way, the line item appropriations don't interfere with the fees. The staffing is covered by a specific budget authority, and it doesn't conflict with the NRC's other work on a regulatory basis because the staff are dedicated to this mission. I think that model, with obviously a lot more fine-tuning, might be the basis for a path forward.
Yeah, that idea is under discussion. There were some people at the meeting who had some thoughts about it to share. One of the speakers at the meeting was a former NRC regulator, Jeffrey Merrifield, who was a regulator for about 8 years and is now advising some of the advanced reactor developers as an attorney working for, I can't remember the name of his company, Pitts something or other, but I'll look it up soon. And Jeff had some thoughts about that. He believes that model has been shown to be reasonably effective. It's the same one that NGNP was following, and I think that was used with some success in the NP 2010 program, where the DOE funded the NRC's participation in a development program. That is a model. There are some considerations about having additional bureaucratic layers and additional decision makers, and also the very real possibility that what the NRC needs to have is some sort of technologically neutral approach that specifies the performance standards that they want the technologies to be able to achieve and develops a way that standardizes the way that the vendors or the applicants can prove that they can meet the performance standards through testing or models and simulation or even the development of a full-scale prototype demonstration plant with some sort of extra protection measures before they release that to the commercial world.
Steve, now that you're talking about standards, let me just throw in the fact that the Idaho National Lab just finished publishing their innovation workshop reports. And one of the things that came out of that is the necessity of test beds for advanced reactors, because you really can't take a reactor to licensing unless you've tested the technology. And the lack of test beds is a critical issue in the U.S. That's not an intended pun. But the key thing, Todd Allen is the senior official at the Idaho Lab, who's been publishing a series of reports on these workshops at the Energy Collective, and he and a couple of his colleagues have pointed out that this testbed issue is a crucial intermediate step on the road to licensing.
Yeah, it's always good to remind people that the Idaho National Laboratory used to have a name called the National Reactor Testing Station, NRTS, and they served as that testbed for about 52 reactors, I believe, during the early stages of its life. Steve, your licensing system in Canada was discussed at the workshop. I can't remember the name of the gentleman who came down and gave a talk about how Canada does a more performance-based licensing approach. Still a very rigorous approach and demands that the vendor demonstrate its safety case, but not so locked into any particular technology. Do you know much about that?
The idea about not locked into a technology really has to is kind of what everybody says. They're a heavy water agency, just like the NRC is a light water agency. But the CNSC is a world class, very professional outfit, as you can tell from whatever gentleman it was that gave the. That gave the presentation, and from the quality of their current president. They've been different in the last few years under the current president, in not in promoting nuclear energy, but in promoting them as a trustworthy voice, assuring the safety of the industry. So it's an interesting case. I don't know how long it's going to last because the current president, his term expires soon, and we've got an election on right now. He was a political appointee, and what happens with the next president is it could radically be quite different, as you know, from down south. That really depends on who's the president.
I'd like to throw something in. This is Les Caris again. To what Steve said, that our American regulatory agency is a light water regulatory agency. And I just took a quick look here at 10 CFR 50, and it seems that he hit the nail right on the head. We don't have regulations, or the NRC looks at not having regulations anyway, for anything other than light water reactors. So their hands are tied, and this goes back to what Rod said in the first place. And the NRC needs a directive, because it looks like they would have to write a regulatory manual or a regulatory system for non-light water reactors.
Well, I think they have to do two things. They have to, first of all, know what constitutes safety for the different advanced reactor types from a technological point of view, and then they have to write regulations that would capture safety requirements and be able to tell an applicant, this is what you have to do to meet our requirements to have a safe reactor. That's the design review and licensing process. So all that's development work that would have to be paid for by line item appropriation from Congress. DOE has to play in the mix there, because the expertise would come, I think, in part from the DOE National Labs and in part from the industry. So it's a multi-agency task. It's not just that the NRC has a hole. The strategy is what do you do to fill it? This is what I've been advocating, and Rod mentioned the people are way ahead of the comments that I'm putting out here because they've talked about it at that conference. I just think that there needs to be a strategy that would pull together all these different pieces that we've talked about and engage these agencies in creating a feasible and cost-effective path forward so that a vendor could have some certainty that they wouldn't have to spend $1 billion getting a safety review and a license for a 100-megawatt advanced reactor.
Absolutely.
And I like all these ideas of how we're going to get the NRC sort of off the dime with either more test beds in the U.S. or different line item appropriations and so forth. My own feeling about it is that people are looking to Canada, which is more performance-based, a little, very, very serious about safety, but not necessarily serious about, a bureaucracy that needs millions of dollars, I mean billions of dollars, before it can look at something new. I think that I go back to the fact that the Canadians, when they were going to build a reactor, they didn't go. They looked at the fact that they didn't have the ability to forge the kind of pressure vessels that the light water reactors had, and they said, "Oh, but we don't have to do it that way. We can do it a different way." And they invented the CANDU reactors, and those have served for years and years and years. I think the Canadian regulatory system is a little more pragmatic and a little more realistic. Do you agree with me, Steve?
Well, I agree that the current CNSC, let's separate president from staff. The staff has always been, back when it was the board, the Atomic Energy Control Board, they evaluate on the basis of safety and I guess they've taken a more pragmatic approach. I don't know their role in the development of the CANDU. They certainly had a role in the layup of those CANDUs in the mid 1990s, but today it's a very well regarded agency, especially in the industry. That's probably not a good selling point for the CNSC among people who are not who are nuclear skeptics or anti nuclear, because they're perceived as being too much in the bed. But if you look at it objectively, they're very solid.
Well, I've always thought they were very solid about regulating for safety, and I didn't mean to imply anything other than that. I'm just saying that, you almost get the feeling that the NRC knows how to regulate a light water reactor, and therefore the rest of the world knows how to regulate a light water reactor because they can follow the NRC. But exactly. The Canadians managed to build a completely different reactor way back when and build bunches of them and sell them abroad and have them regulated by their regulatory agency without just kind of copying. Let's see how the NRC does it.
Well, okay, in that point of view, I see what you're getting. Absolutely, it's a model of an agency that doesn't have to do light water. That's right. And you've got, I don't know what Dan was mentioning, the Finns advising was it the UAE, Dan, or was it the Saudis? I can't remember who. But
the Finns have been advising the Saudis for some time on regulatory structure and how to pull things together. But the Saudis have moved very slowly to implement a regulatory structure. They're still, I would put them in the thinking about it stage, though they do have an agency. But it's, I think, a very coming off the boards at a moderate pace. It might be the most diplomatic way of saying it.
My question would be, what did the Finns use as their regulatory model? Did they use the NRC?
Well, that was kind of. I don't know what they did, but it's they're a light water country, and my God, this business with Olkiluoto, was is it two or three? This is just incredible. I don't know how much of that is related to the regulator. I mean, come on, it can't all be Areva. There's some analysis paralysis that must have afflicted that agency, as well as the French regulator, because look at what's happening at Flamanville. Again, unless the EPR is some dog, and I don't think that it is, there's a lot of I don't know whether either the French or the Finns borrowed their model from the NRC. There's some stuff that's really carrying on.
Well, in my point of view, the EPR is not necessarily a dog any more than a Rolls Royce is a dog. It's just a very large, expensive, difficult to build reactor where there's plenty of places for people to question the quality of work in certain places and hold up the construction process. So far, no EPR anywhere in the world is operating, so there still may be some unproven ideas and components that haven't yet had their chance to fail because nobody's tried to start one up. So I'm still a little bit of a skeptic on the EPR, particularly knowing the history of why Siemens and Areva decided they needed to come up with a completely new design rather than simply doing whatever modifications were necessary on the N4 to continue their ability to build reactors. So that's my take these days is, although I'm a huge proponent of nuclear energy, I'm not a real fan of the way that the established industry has developed its products for sale, expecting the customers to take so much of the risk associated with building something new. Most industries that have any respect in my mind build their concept cars or their prototype airplanes, and they do the test flights before they expect the customers to lay down the dollars to purchase said devices.
Just on getting back to Finland on Steve's comment, I'm not sure what model they use, but there has been a lot of contention in Finland for market share between France and Russia. As you know, the latest reactor for Finland has just now been approved for construction by Rosatom. But the thing to keep in mind about just how nefarious things can get in Finland is that the previous economic minister, Jukka Laaksonen, signed off on Rosatom's role in that fifth reactor and then went to work for Rosatom to gain funding and government approval for it. So you have to understand the Russians regard Finland somewhat as their sphere of influence, their territory. This is just another example of that. I don't know if Areva is entirely responsible for all the troubles they've had there. They've had a lot of trouble with Mr. Jukka Laaksonen before he left. There were a lot of disputes that held things up. There were a lot of issues over whether or not the concrete met nuclear specifications. They had a tremendous problem with labor forces. They had people from 5-6 different countries all speaking different languages. Good luck meeting nuclear requirements and construction with that kind of communication issue. There were a lot of things going on there. And then Siemens and Areva were not, the happiest of partners in all of that. As Rod will recall, maybe others do, when they decided to go their separate ways, there was a big cash payoff to Siemens from Areva for splitting up that partnership because they just had enough.
Well, and it's a little bit like a divorce where there's still children involved, because I believe that Siemens still has a role that has to be played in this particular project, and they're not completely out of it, even though there's been a separation on the EPR. So people can prove to me that I'm wrong, but I believe that there is still some role that Siemens is playing in that project. That may be, again, cause for some difficulty. They are big plants. I mean, each one of the EPRs produces 1,650 to 1,750 megawatts, depending on how cold the water is where they're building it, which means the Finland reactor will be a little bit on the high side once they get operating. But it's hard. It's difficult to basically put your industry to sleep for 20 years and then try to start it back up again with building a reactor that large. And in the U.S., we have a problem of having been asleep for 35 years before starting to rebuild. So we've had our own issues associated with building new reactors, some learning experiences, getting workforces developed and quality assurance programs in place. Even though we all speak English, sometimes we have different versions of English here in the U.S., and there's regulatory English, and there's Southern English, and there's, anyway, you get the point. So we also have our own officials who have some very strange decision processes while they're government officials, and then immediately take employment with somebody who may have benefited by those decision processes. So Mr. Poneman, if you're listening to this podcast, I am talking about you. So I'll let other people.
I love the fact that you brought up Dan Poneman because I've been waiting all evening to throw a rock in the pond and make some waves about that. When he was the undersecretary at the Department of Energy, he was very much soft-pedaled nuclear energy, especially in international forums, raising instead the non-proliferation flag, and also because the Obama administration was trying to cement the green wing of the Democratic Party together, promoting renewables. Now he has left the government and is CEO of Centrus Energy, formerly a uranium enrichment firm, which we all know as USEC. And he is now a marvelous advocate for nuclear energy. It's a role reversal, or I'm not sure what the right term is here, of magnificent proportions. He's at World Nuclear Association meeting. He is now talking about a robust nuclear growth scenario, which is just great. But I think it depends. What you say depends on where you sit. And with that, I'll be quiet.
I think that's a case of if he was going to defend himself, he'd say, listen, the reason I got out was I didn't like towing that renewables line, and you got to tow that line if you want employment in that agency.
Yep, and he's getting a good salary at Centrus. I think about $1.7 million a year. So he apparently is doing something worth that. There is some controversy about his decision to move directly from a position that has the appearance of some conflicts of interest and a reward for favorable treatment that Centrus or USEC was being given by DOE as they tried to develop the American Centrifuge project and basically we're on life support with some rather interesting arrangements from selling off DOE-owned enrichment tails, which still had a fairly high portion of uranium-235 in them and could be used to produce some new lightly enriched uranium by going through the re-enrichment process. So there's all kinds of interesting machinations associated with that particular decision to move from DOE into the industry. So
I just think the history of USC and now Centrus is aptly described by it. Ain't over till the fat lady sings. And I think she's still in the wings. I don't think she's going to sing yet as far as Centrus is concerned. They may have yet new legs to stand on relative to government funding for that. We'll see.
So I'm looking at my clock and realizing that we're getting kind of close to what I normally view as the soft cutoff point for an atomic show. Even people with the worst commutes in the country usually run out of steam sometime around the hour and 20 minute, hour and a half point. So what I'd like to do is to let each of the guests here jump in with an issue that is relatively short but important to them, and then we'll get together again soon and bring these kinds of conversations back into being. My summer of traveling is now over, and maybe I'll be able to devote a little more time to getting my friends together to share good information about nuclear energy with the rest of you. So let's start with Meredith. What's going on up there in Vermont these days? How is your electric power system doing after Vermont Yankee shut down?
Well, it's the summer, so it's doing fine. Because basically, during the summer, natural gas isn't diverted to heating homes. So that we have a grid that's about 50% natural gas. Natural gas is inexpensive now, and so it's not doing badly. What's going to happen in the winter is another question. When natural gas does that get diverted to heating homes, when you know the Vermont Yankee isn't running anymore, it's going to be different. But one of the things that's bothering me is that there's all these reports coming out of Vermont saying how the green industry of solar installations have grown, and really have to write a blog post about that, because their statistics are, let's say,
suspect.
Statistics and their spin, let's put it that way. So, but I've got to do a little more analysis to do the blog post.
And I always recommend people read the wonderful classic book called How to Lie with Statistics.
Yes, great book. Thank you.
Les, what's going on up there in Cleveland? I'm going to let you talk about Cleveland, and I'll ask Dan to talk about something else.
Well, the most important thing is the Ohio State Buckeyes, but we're not going there. my thing that I'm most interested in right now, outside of Fukushima, which is kind of a daily thing for me, has to do with a set of petitions that have been filed with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on behalf of an organization that I'm a part of, and you are too, Rod, Scientists for Accurate Radiation Information, on revisiting the model being used to set regulations, the linear no-threshold model, which should be rejected because it has absolutely no scientific support for it, and be replaced by a threshold model, which has a mountain of scientific support. And hopefully we'll be seeing some positive results here over the next couple of years. And that's my main outside Japan focus.
Okay, and I will, I think, Meredith, you're also a member of SERI.
Yes, I am. I've done at least one blog post about the comment I made on the petitions about getting away from the LNT model. I have that on the blog post, and I have links to how you can comment and so forth on my blog post.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been doing on my own initiative is to stop calling it the linear no threshold response and call it either the no threshold or the no safe dose model, because unfortunately, and Meredith, you have been involved in this as well. Many of the people who respond reflexively to defend their model focus on whether or not it's linear, linear quadratic, or linear quadratic with a DDREF, or I don't know what that is, but DODEF adjustment. You know, they start talking about, and they distract people with a very large argument about the mathematics behind their best fit models and all. The key is, to me, that the assertion is that no matter how small the dose is, there is an additional risk associated with it. And I think that's the part of the model that really needs to be overcome, for very good reasons, because it is not a conservative, protective thing to tell people. Because there are many people in the world who have, for no fault of their own, already been exposed to low levels of radiation. Matter of fact, all of us, through no fault of our own, have already been exposed to low levels of radiation. Almost everybody that I know has had medical procedures of one form or another that expose them to low-level radiation. And then there are those unfortunate people in the areas of Chernobyl and Fukushima who have been exposed to low levels. And if the no-threshold dose model is correct, and it's not, but if it was, those people have a legitimate right to be worried for the rest of their lives. Have I got something inside me that I can't change, I can't correct, I can't cure, and my body can't heal? Am I condemned already? And that's a very bad position to be in. It's psychologically damaging to tell people that they've already not only have the potential for developing, they have a higher risk of developing cancer sometime down the road, but they may be carrying some sort of undetected, unmeasurable genetic issue that may show up in a generation or two or three down the road. So they may really worry about whether they should have children or not. That's a terrible model and a terrible thing that the proponents of that model have condemned the rest of the people to believe. It is a belief in witches, a ghost, or something else that's unproven, but you can't prove they don't exist, right? Isn't that right?
Rod, it's a belief in the boogeyman that's being given legitimacy, if you will.
Well, it's a created boogeyman.
Exactly. Aren't they all?
Well, yes, and there's, in most cases, when boogeymen, witches, ghosts have been created, somebody had a reason for doing that. And in this case, there is an enormous amount of evidence that shows that the people who created the no threshold model out of whole cloth, they didn't have any experimental evidence, and they were going against the accepted model that had been in place for 50 years, that there were doses that were, you didn't have to worry about because they were so low they couldn't harm anybody, or they couldn't find, there was nothing that could be found that indicated harm, and you gave yourself a nice buffer between the area where you could find harm and the area where you actually limited yourself. The people who created the no threshold, no safe dose model, created a whole cloth, and they had reasons for it. Very solid economic reasons to discourage a competitor, and some of them were certainly well motivated by the belief that they had to do something, anything, to stop the U.S. and Russia from exploding nuclear weapons in the atmosphere. So, all right. So I've just stopped my rant of the day, and on to Steve. What's going on up there in Canada, Steve?
The Darlington plant is down. That represents about 3,600 megawatts. It's down for a vacuum building outage. It's not putting any power into the grid. And guess what's happened to the carbon content of each kilowatt hour of Ontario electricity since the Darlington plant came down for that?
Has it increased? Or yeah, it must have increased.
It increased. Yeah. It's gone up to over 100 grams per kilowatt hour, which is uncommonly high for Ontario. So that's what happens when you take a nuclear plant out of service. Wind hasn't kicked up. Wind has got a capacity of about 2,500 megawatts. Right this minute, it's putting 181 megawatts in. So a small percentage of its capacity. It's very unreliable, and you can't count on it to reduce carbon. I just want to make a prediction. Next year, watch what's happening in China. There's going to be an announcement about one of the Chinese CANDUs running a full core of reprocessed uranium, reprocessed and depleted in a natural uranium equivalent isotopic ratio. That's going to be the first time that the reactor is run on a full core of that kind of fuel, and it's going to be a game changer in the fuel recycling business.
Is that a Dupic?
Nope. No, Dupic is is a light water spent fuel that's been chopped up and refashioned to CANDU. This is reprocessed uranium from China, as you know, also does reprocessing. So the fissile uranium content of the reprocessed uranium portion of the MOX uranium or the plutonium uranium stream, plus depleted uranium, mixed together to form a natural uranium equivalent, like I said, isotopic ratio. It's a very interesting concept. It's going to, if it succeeds, and it probably will, revolutionize China's nuclear industry in terms of the back end fuel cycle and facilitate their breeder program while allowing them to continue with light water enriched uranium and hopefully a few more CANDUs.
Thanks,
that's
Steve.
Interesting.
All right, Dan, I think that you're up.
I'm going to talk about Coal State, Kentucky, embracing nuclear energy. Third time might be the try. As you know, the state has a law which has a moratorium. Basically, coal interests didn't want the competition. The green groups saw an opportunity to put a cork in the bottle. And since the mid-1980s, law has been until there's a national waste repository, you're not building any nukes in Kentucky. A guy named Representative Gerald Watkins has joined forces with Len Peters, the energy czar. And they did a presentation last week to the Kentucky General Assembly Joint Committee. This is on the House side. And they want to lift that moratorium for Paducah, Kentucky, which, as you know, is a uranium enrichment site. And authorize the ability to build a reactor there. And they may be making some headway. The state Senate went on record in favor of the idea last year. The governor's in favor of it. And the legislative session that comes up in 2016 is going to take up the bill. Watkins is also getting some national play. He's just been named to the National Conference of State Legislatures Nuclear Legislative Work Group. And that work group primarily is a forum for DOE to talk to states about their environmental restoration program. But DOE also talks to the states about reuse of DOE facilities, which is one of the things that the people in Paducah would dearly love to see since the facility closed 2 years ago. So they are pursuing that, and we're going to see if the representatives in the House from the eastern half of the state, which is the coal region, will go for it.
I'm glad you brought that up. I know, and I can't remember the name of the company, so I'm just going to leave it there. Here's a mystery to solve, but at least one of the advanced reactor company leaders that was at the meeting, DOE, NRC, told me that they have a site now where they're going to start doing their real focused design license effort, and that site is Paducah. So I'm not sure who it was. I wonder what that must be. Something worth looking up. All right. Yeah, there's a good reason why Paducah would love to have a nuclear plant there. They have a lot of people who are skilled in the regulations and the handling of radioactive material, and know that the jobs are good and they're clean and they're reliable. As long as you get the facility up and running, they can last for generations. I really want to thank you all for attending, for taking some time out of your evening to chat. It's been too long since we last talked, and there are plenty of things going on in the nuclear arena, either with technology or politics or helping people understand why they should get excited about nuclear energy. I'm particularly excited about hearing some of the young people like Leslie Dewan and Caroline Cochran and Jacob DeWitt and meeting some of the people who are interested in advanced reactors. I was excited to attend that DOE NRC workshop. And I also want to leave you all with the thought, those who have had a long time maybe distrust of government activities or particularly the NRC, one of my Naval Academy classmates is a senior civilian working at the NRC, and I happened to see him this last weekend, and he mentioned to me, I mentioned that I attended this advanced reactor workshop, and he said, that's a big topic in my agency these days, and he went on to talk to somebody else about, you know, the running back at Navy who'd had a great day, but it just something to pass on to you guys that within the NRC, the senior people are paying attention to the fact that they definitely have people who want them to develop the capabilities to allow the U.S. to again take a leading role in developing some really useful advanced technologies, some of which have been under discussion and even development for the last 55 years. So with that, good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.